Question number 261, brass band is a cultural bridge between Mormon Utah and the eastern United States. I am actually from the eastern United States, so I've got that tie-in. I have just been speaking with our speaker, Bryant Smith, and he seems super engaging. I think you guys are in for a treat. Bryant Smith is an assistant professor of music at Columbia Basin College in Pasco, Washington. He holds degrees from the University of Northern Colorado, Brigham Young University, and the University of Utah. He is a specialist in wind band conducting, and he's also a band historian. Today's presentation is based on research from his dissertation, the title of which is Mormon Brass Bands and the Westward Migration from 1830 to 1920, including an edition and transcription of the Capstone March by Charles John Thomas, D.A. So just a few notes before we get started. Make sure that you have silenced your cell phones. I'm sure you've already done that. Also, if you have a chance to go take a look at the book sales downstairs, you probably also know this already, but a portion of the proceeds from those book sales go to Sunstone and help to carry on the tradition. This session is being recorded, so if you have a question at the end, please use the microphone right there so that your question can be recorded and so that we have a record of that, and so that the response from Bryant makes a little bit more sense. All right, with no further ado, let's hear from Bryant.
Thank you. Good afternoon. How are you all today? Good. I won't mind you talking in food. That's a wonderful thing. For starters, I just wanted to let you know that this is a presentation about music. It's about band music. And it's about what was brought to Utah from the East and how band music became a major player in Mormon culture. And to start with, I'd just like to play a little something for you. This is a piece of music called the Capstone March, which was a march played in 1892 at the dedication of the laying of the cornerstone for the Salt Lake Temple. And it was played by John Held and his band and was found during my dissertation research. So I thought it'd be fun to listen just for a minute to tune our ears in to what we're talking about today. So let's see if we can get this going for us here.
Take it, this is a modern band.
This is a modern band, yes. The audio back in those days was not quite as profound as today. This is the BYU Wind Ensemble, and we made a band transcription for them. So here we go. First time you've heard it in over 100 and some odd years, right? Well, the purpose of this particular paper, now that we have our ears tuned towards the music and what it was that they would have been listening to in those days, is to shed light on the importance of brass bands in Mormon culture and to highlight the similarities between Mormon bands and those from the eastern United States. Because, again, of my interest in American history, in my interest in band history as a band musician, I felt it was important to look at it from a comparative outlook and looking at how they fit into the American cultural landscape. So for a little bit of background here, brass bands in 19th century America were plentiful. The brass band movement originated in Boston and New York around 1835, and with each band, they would have between 1 and 3 percussion instruments, 6 and 20 brass instruments, depending on where they were. Brass bands quickly became America's popular music, playing for parties and for graduations, dances, fairs, building completions, railroads, parades, arriving dignitaries, and all sorts of impromptu performances known as serenades. Realizing their social value, towns promoted bands in their communities. As put by band historians Robert and Margaret Hazen, progress was almost unthinkable without bands, and to fail to support them was to be dumb, backward, and uncivilized. That's a wonderful way of putting it. Perhaps this is one reason why the Mormon people readily accepted brass bands into their early church history. Established in 1830, Joseph Smith claimed that the church that he founded, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, was the church that was the Church of Christ restored to the earth after the death of the original apostles. This belief may have been part of that emphasis for having a brass band. Rather than be dumb, backward, and uncivilized, Joseph saw his community of Latter-day Saints as the kingdom of God on the earth. As Michael Hicks has said, on the frontier of America, perhaps nothing less than a brass band would confirm Nauvoo's pretensions to greatness. Little is known about the first band in Mormon history, which performed at the far west cornerstone laying for the temple in 1838. But just a year later, after the relocation of the Saints to Nauvoo, band music became a major contributor to Mormon culture. As band music was a traditional part of American militia units, the Nauvoo Legion, shown here, by the way, you can see the band in the bottom left there, the Nauvoo Legion, which was a mostly Mormon militia, created the Nauvoo Brass Band with encouragement from Joseph Smith. Later, church leader George A. Smith remarked that Joseph blessed this band and it is bound to ride over all prejudice. The message was that because Joseph Smith approved of brass band music, it was acceptable in church culture. Soon, this band was playing at events outside of their military duties. Just like their counterparts in American towns, they played for dancing parties, concerts, and building projects. They also marched in parades and serenaded town members. Remarkably, they also played for church meetings and temple ceremonies. This is an example of how the Mormon people accepted a pop culture musical entity and made it their own. Band or martial music became so important that Terrell Givens has stated that the abiding nucleus of the music scene would not be choral, but martial. Had band music been merely a dictate of Joseph Smith, it likely would not have continued in Mormon communities after his sudden death in 1844. But band music was truly loved by the Mormon people. The arrival of Joseph's body in Nauvoo and his viewing and funerary services were all attended to by the brass band, a tradition that was continued for the next four of his successors. When Brigham Young assumed leadership of the church, bands became increasingly important to Mormons. Because of the increasing hostilities toward the Mormon people, Young began the exodus from Nauvoo in 1846. He told the saints to gather without delay to the place appointed and to go with sweet instruments of music and of melody and songs. Amongst the few important possessions and supplies loaded into their wagons, band instruments were included. Throughout the journey that eventually led to the Salt Lake Valley, band music became a critical aid to the saints on the plains. The Nauvoo Brass Band members and their families traveled as a group in company with Brigham Young. At night, Young would call the camp together, and the band would play, and the people would dance. One account records that after clearing the snow and building a fire, the band played its merriest airs and attracted curious island community members who were amazed to see this group of exiles fleeing persecution, enjoying the music of a band on the plains. Their ability to lift the spirits of the saints, to strengthen the feeble knees and lift up the hands that hang down, was often palpable. Of the bands performing during the United States 1840s period, it is unlikely that any had similar of significance. After arriving in Salt Lake City, Brigham Young set to work building up the church, communities, and culture. He established over 400 settlements in the West. Among those settlers sent out under Young's supervision were specifically chosen musicians who were given the charge to go out to these new communities and establish musical ensembles. These new ensembles would then support everyone in the town, and everyone would enjoy their music. As a result, brass bands began to grow in number. Three were established in Salt Lake City before 1851. By 1856, 14 more bands had been created. And by the early 1870s, at least 49 more bands were created in a variety of remote mountain locations. In each of these towns, the American, and now Mormon, tradition of brass band performances became the norm. By comparison, only a few bands were created in surrounding territories at the time, such as the Sacramento, California Band in 1859 and the Prescott, Arizona Band in 1864. Musically, it was only on the rarest of occasions that residents were given the opportunity to enjoy any kind of formal, dramatic, or musical entertainment in those territories. Now, to the comparisons. The period of 1860 to 1900 was the apex of band popularity in America and among the Latter-day Saints. Although isolated from the American population at large, the Mormons possessed and attracted enough cultural and musical knowledge to develop a band tradition. During these years, functions of brass bands in Utah were similar to those in the greater United States. Bands understood American traditions. They built on them and eventually merged themselves with those of the American brass band movement. This cultural bridge was an important sign that Mormons were willingly connected to American culture. Comparisons of their music and cultural events best illustrate these connections. So during the 19th century, grand concerts featuring bands, soloists, and small ensembles were common in the United States. This is a program here from Vermont, which has a number of different pieces that are presented. Also, they had roller skating going on at the same time, so that was a good thing for them. It featured three different brass bands, the Worcester Brass Band, White's Military Band, and the Worcester Cadet Band. What's interesting to note is the program. There's selections, there's vocal selections, there's a clarinet solo, there's different songs being performed. The grand concert tradition, which we see here, was brought with the Mormons to the Salt Lake Valley and was perpetuated for decades after their arrival, complete with bands and solos. This is one of the Mormon ones that was done in 1850. And you see again, we have solo violin with accompaniment, you have a solo flute piece, a comic song, but then you also have the playing of band pieces to begin and end the act, sometimes in the middle. So they're all over the place. Music from the grand concerts was particularly insightful. American bands often programmed popular dances, such as polkas, waltzes, and quadrilles, as well as short marches during encores, songs with vocalists, or arranged instrumental versions that were closely linked to the music of pop culture. The same may be said of Mormon bands, who played many popular tunes at grand concerts. Brigham Young was particularly partial to My Old Kentucky Home, Decamp Town Races, and, as we see at the end of Act 1 here, Oh, Susanna. Wonderful pieces of music that Brigham Young loved to hear. Now, for balls and dancing, here's another wonderful thing that happened in America during the 19th century. If you look on the left here, we have a dance at Harvard, and the one on the right is in New York, the New York Academy, an indoor one versus an outdoor. They similarly would play at these events, waltzes and quadrilles and polkas and gallops, and they were played throughout the year at various times. Similarly, balls and dances in Utah territory were often held in conjunction with significant community events, such as fairs. For example, in 1862, the Ballot Band held a picnic party and ball to celebrate the state fair in Salt Lake City. But dancing was not reserved only for large events. Some were invited events for special occasions. Again, same thing as what happened in the East. This here on the left, let's say, yeah, your left, is the Rutland Cornet Band and an invitation to one of their balls. Nice and formal, wonderful to see. But on the right hand, we get what we would have seen in 1850 in Utah, an invitation to a military ball by Domenico Ballo. And you'll see that it has the same information of, okay, you need to be there, dancing is at such and such a time, please come and enjoy. What's also interesting about this is that there's a second page to the Mormon one, which shows the program. And program is very interesting because if you look at the top four right here, there, those are marches written specifically for all the members of the First Presidency. And they were written, you can see the first one, it says Governor, of course, Brigham Young would have been governor at the same time, but Governor Young's Grand March and so forth. This is very similar, actually, not to an American, but to a European tradition of when royalty, such as the French, when the kings would enter into the room, an overture was played in order to bring them into the room. Same exact thing going on here, but now with the Romans. So, in addition to these balls and dances, there were also dances held in the general public. English convert Claudius Bramwell, who settled in Plain City in 1869, said, "All the towns around had a brass band and a baseball nine. Each ward furnished their own amusements and fun by having a dance or drama each week. Our team and brass band would visit a town, play our opponents an afternoon baseball game, followed by a dance in the evening." It looked like a wonderful day to me. Now, for parades, of course, American brass bands were among the most conspicuous participants. Parades were the perfect forum for showing off a band's musical ability, resplendent uniforms, and shiny horns. Parade marching adopted standard formations with rows of columns that were kept tight so that the musicians could clearly hear each other. The drum major who taught music and marching led the band. This is a parade in South Dakota in 1906. In Utah, practices were much the same as in Eastern America, even though flashy uniforms and horns were not at first the norm. Little is mentioned about visual appearance in early pioneer parades, though pictures show Utah bands that, if not in a military-style uniform, have coordinated jackets, pants, and shirts. Bands are listed in practically every parade report on record during the time. This is a Utah band, the John Held Band, and a picture of them in 1900. Again, you notice the columns and rows that we continue to see with all those marching bands on Pioneer Day and 4th of July, same thing. Just as mainstream America used brass band music to foster patriotism, Mormon brass bands played Yankee Doodle, the Star-Spangled Banner, Hail Columbia, and Lamar Soleil's as well. At patriotic holidays, parades, and political rallies, this music was expected, but it was also played at picnics, military exercises, social events, church services, and temple ceremonies. Mormons used American patriotic music to unify their culture and show their support for the Union despite their conflicts. For Mormon band, or excuse me, for performances, bands often played on bandwagons, a practice that was widespread in Utah Territory and corresponded to the pattern of American carriage use at the time. In the East, bands used them to add drama and excitement to band performances. The one on the top left would be your Eastern correspondent in Michigan. High-end wagons were large, ornately painted, featured the name of the band on its side, and were drawn by a number of horses. If a band could not afford such a wagon, lower-cost alternatives, including basic wooden designs or common farm wagons, were used. Band wagons also allowed bands to move equipment easily and let them perform in a lot of variety of locations, and also add to a sense of unity among the band members. Utah bands followed the trend. The Nauvoo Brass Band was the first to use bandwagons in the Western Mormon communities. Their first performances in a bandwagon was in 1850. The Nauvoo Brass Band's bandwagon was 9 feet wide, 29 feet long, and drawn by 14 horses. If any of you have a picture of this, I really want to see it. So please share. Other ones, of course, soon followed. For example, the Springville Bandwagon was premiered a few years later, and the Lehigh Silver Band, which is shown here on the bottom right, was premiered in 1891. That bandwagon still resides in Lehigh in Bandwagon Park in the center of town, so you can go and see that one. Now, along with parades, Utah Territory bands were heavily involved in patriotic celebrations. Like the rest of the country, their presence at Independence Day, Washington's Birthday, and Pioneer Day celebrations were anticipated. The LDS Church, which helped with scheduling the parades, ensured the brass bands were included in the festivities. These performances are an example of Utah's increasing connections to mainstream America. This particular image here from the president's office, Wilford Woodruff at the time was the president for the Jubilee celebration. And if you look on the first one where it says Section 1, it says Presidency of the Church and Apostles in Carriages. That's this one right here. Right below that, you'll see Section 2, Nauvoo Band on Float. And then it says in parentheses, they are feeble folk. That's because there were only a few surviving members of the Nauvoo Brass Band left in 1897. And so they were given a place of honor in the parade. There were, of course, other brass bands that were performing during this parade, but I thought it was nice to see them recognized. They also got medals as well, I might add, the Nauvoo Brass Band members, and they're very cool to look at. Now, like the eastern United States, the 4th of July in Mormon communities began with band music. Morning services featured orations by church and city officials, interspersed with band selections. Participation in serenades, concerts, and parades would follow throughout the day. In 1867, the 4th of July activities included 7 band performances interspersed between orations. After the program, bands were stationed throughout the city on prominent buildings for performances. Their placement at various city locations, including on top of the domed Salt Lake Tabernacle, shows that their performances were more than just functional, they were aesthetic. Having 4 bands play within a radius of only a few miles would have meant that band music was heard in practically every location in the heart of the city. Of all the performance opportunities for bands, though, during the 19th century, serenades were among the most popular. A combination of concerts and parades, these performances could be given virtually anywhere to honor the residents or guests in a town. In mainstream America, these serenades brought up a performance practice that was followed everywhere. Most bands hoped to take the honored person by surprise. So, the musicians tended to gather quickly, and usually under the cover of darkness. Forming a circle near the targeted residence, the bands would launch into a rousing popular song, to be followed in quick succession by 1 or 2 more selections. If the performance was enjoyed, the musical efforts were acknowledged in some way. If things had really gone well, the entire band would be invited indoors for refreshments and socializing. American serenading customs were well known to the Mormons. Mormon bands serenaded often. The diary of piccolo player Charles Smith is filled with references of Ballo's band serenading Brigham Young and his counselors. On July 4th, 1861, Smith left his home at 3 a.m., met with band members, played Hail Columbia, and serenaded the main city streets with other bands. They arrived at President Young's house, where they gave him 3 cheers. President Young then took off his hat as an acknowledgement. Young's acknowledgement is an important clue that he understood the rules of American serenading. Outside of Salt Lake, bands and their audiences up and down the Mormon corridor of the West understood serenading customs too. The St. George Brass Band serenaded communities like Washington and Santa Clara. In 1866, just a month after beginning to study music, Charles L. Walker recorded that the band serenaded Erastus Snow. After a cordial invitation into his home, we entertained him and his family with our performance of our brass instruments for some time. I suppose this is the first time these black volcanic rocks and this desert region were saluted by the strains from a brass band. Despite serenading's popularity, bands had to be musically prepared. In 1890, 14 untrained men in Lake Town procured instruments and formed a brass band. On the night that the instruments were distributed, the band members gathered to serenade the town and made all the noise possible. It is said that all the dogs left town and one lame ox ran away so fast his lameness was cured.
It's worth noting there still aren't very many people in Lake Town.
No, that's true. I hope the brass band has improved since then.
That's funny.
Once the musicians had practiced enough to be invited in for refreshments, bands needed to stay on their best behavior. If they were not, they risked not being invited back. Such was the case with Alan McCustion's brass band in Tooele County, who on one occasion was offered some dried peach pie for refreshments. The pie didn't taste very good. So when no one was looking, the band members dumped their pie into the bell of the big bass horn. The bass horn player, named Nels Johnson, did not see this transaction. Thinking that the visit had gone well, he said to his fellow band members, "Let us play one more tune for these good people." "No, it is too late," they said. But he persisted. But when he blew into the horn, no noise came out. Puzzled, he turned the horn upside down and out poured the pieces of pie. The band never received an invitation to play in that home again. In addition to patriotic events and serenades, Mormon bands, like their Eastern equivalents, perform military and civic services, such as playing at political rallies, railroad openings, and funerals. Utah militia units expanded into surrounding communities, and each fulfilled the Legion mandate to enlist musicians. They performed for visiting generals who came. There's an account of that general coming into town and then being dismissed and playing for them. They were known as the Brethren of the group, and so it's interesting to see how the church and the militia mindset were overlapping at that time. That was in the late 1850s. Now, the history of American bands at rallies goes back to the 1840s, when quick marches were composed for the Whig Convention in Boston, and bands marched to Boston Common and Bunker Hill. During the 1850s and 60s, brass bands played at political conventions, like the one for Abraham Lincoln. There's one of his rallies for him, and then there were also ones when he was elected and so forth. Bands in the Mormon West performed similar roles. In 1863, a band participated in a meeting where a petition to President Lincoln was signed. In 1870, in St. George, the brass band played at the Indignation Meeting to protest against the passage of the Cullum Bill in the Senate. Cullum Bill was essentially restricting rights for those who were involved in polygamy. Another political trend in the 1880s America was torchlight processions, where large numbers of people and brass bands marched together. An example was a Republican procession in 1880 in New York City, where thousands of people and five brass bands marched, and they would often end in rallies. Torchlight events from the East became the model for similar events in the West, as Utah moved closer to statehood. In August of 1889, the People's Party, a political party backed by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the church's newspaper, the Deseret News, held torchlight processions and rallies in Ogden and Salt Lake City. Similar rallies were held again in Salt Lake City in 1890 near the Social Hall. Newspaper coverage showed that they played Hail Columbia and rallied around the flag boys, what we would know as the battle cry of freedom today. Accounts of political rallies in Utah show how Mormon communities and bands were adopting a more mainstream American way of life. With railroad expansion, which I've mentioned or talked about briefly, the history of that ties closely with brass bands. The driving of the Golden Spike in 1869 at Promontory Summit marked the completion of the first transcontinental railroad. Just like other completions of railroads, brass bands were there. Here's one of them. Music for that ceremony was provided by the 21st Infantry Division Band, which came to Utah from Virginia. That's this band here. And also a Utah band, Dimmick B. Huntington's Marshall Band, which played Mill May, Yankee Doodle, and There's Nay Luck About the House. It was a wonderful song, by the way. Fun lyrics. Now, a little bit more on the solemn side. American bands often played for funerals. Presidents, military leaders, prominent citizens, and members of fraternal organizations had brass bands present for their funeral processions, ceremonies, and interments. In similar fashion, Mormons in Utah used the brass band to celebrate the lives of the deceased. Utah brass bands followed the American traditions heard at the funerals of United States presidents. Like this one here, by the way, this is Abraham Lincoln's funeral procession. The band is right there, right in front of the horses. Let's see. So they had a certain tradition for when music was played at these presidential funerals. There would be a solemn slow march, or several, for the walk to the cemetery, a dirge or two for the lowering of the coffin, and several lighter quick-step marches for the return to the funeral party. Funeral processions for each LDS church president show the esteem for Mormon leaders by their citizens. For Brigham Young, who died in 1877, a procession led by the 10th Ward Brass Band made its way to the burial plot and played a funeral march. John Taylor's 1887 funeral cortege featured 7 brass bands. For Wilford Woodruff's 1898 funeral, which we have pictured of here, 3 bands played. And in 1901, for Lorenzo Snow, Held's band played a funeral march as the procession went to the rail depot. The body was then taken to Brigham City, where a brass band took him to the cemetery. And at the interment, the band played Near My God to Thee. Now, while this presentation is focused on the similarities between Eastern American bands and Mormon brass bands in the West, it should be noted that Mormons adapted the American band traditions into their own unique church activities. These included playing at general and local conferences and at temple dedicatory events. Bands' participation at conferences usually preceded prominent speakers and played as the congregation departed and gathered. During the temple dedications, they were an integral part of the groundbreaking, cornerstone, capstone, and dedicatory services for the St. George, Logan, Manti, and Salt Lake temples. Now for decline, to talk about where they went, what happened to these brass bands in the remaining minutes. By 1890, the bands in Utah had essentially bridged themselves with the traditions of their counterparts across the country. They were functioning in identical ways to national trends and were increasingly becoming separated from the church that had originally fostered their art. Mormon brass bands were about to go into decline. Utah was admitted to the Union in 1896, and with statehood came an increased separation of church and government. Mormon citizens began to adapt to cultural changes while maintaining their religious convictions. The dichotomy created the tendency to differentiate between the Mormon community and the larger society. The division affected the bands as their role was increasingly relegated to the larger society rather than the church and its members. Still, band music was one place where statehood transition was made a little easier. For decades, brass bands had been integrating musical aspects of popular society into their cultural offerings, so their performances at American-style events were already well understood and helped ease that transition from Mormon separatism into conventional Americanism. But even before statehood, church leaders began to make changes that affected band music, leading to their association with community more than the church. For John Taylor, who became president in 1880, bands were already a cultural fixture. They required minimal investment and really very little maintenance. His successor, Wilford Woodruff, proclaimed the Tabernacle Choir members to be musical missionaries, and this elevated the status of the choir and shifted attention away from the bands. Evan Stevens, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir's conductor, whom Woodruff had appointed, became the prominent figure in clarifying policies relating to church music. He, along with Wilford Woodruff and his successor, Lorenzo Snow, encouraged piano, organ, and singing instruction in local congregations and gave less and less attention to band instruments. Joseph F. Smith supported music in church schools, which included brass bands, but there is very little indication that he had significant contact with brass bands during his presidency. In the end, church education, along with their bands, would largely be turned over to the state during the administration of Heber J. Grant. Also for the church, statehood meant a transition to a more modern image, revamping its appearance through public relations campaigns. Music became a major part of their campaign, with the Tabernacle Choir being their most important emissary. The choir became the standard for music in the church, especially after the 1893 World's Fair performance in Chicago. Brass bands were neither taken to the fair nor included in the church's outreach programs. They were left to communities to maintain. Increasingly, the church turned to choral music that was viewed as more spiritually uplifting. By 1920, when the first church music committee was established, the committee focused on choir, vocal, piano, and organ music, implying that bands were no longer a factor in official church music. The church education system was the final thing that changed for bands. Band involvement in Mormon schools began at Brigham Young Academy in 1892. This is one of the bands at Brigham Young Academy. Please excuse the BYU sign in there. I know we are on the University of Utah campus. Just let that slide for now. I'll sing Utah Man later.
Right. It's archaic. That fits.
It works. There you go. The bands that appeared in Mormon academies during the late 1890s actually predate the appearance of school bands in most Eastern American schools, which began to appear around 1900. By 1910, there were at least 15 bands throughout the church academy system, seven of which received academic credit. From 1910 to 1920, 17 state-run high schools established bands in the in addition to the 22 church schools that already had them. In 1926, due to the expense of running high schools, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints turned general education over to the state and largely abandoned the academies. Band involvement then officially became part of state-run academic traditions. The educational shift shows the last form of church sanction for brass bands in official church culture, thus abandoning the distinction of being a Mormon brass band. By the way, this education reform is happening across the country. Community bands were then going to be turned into school bands, and school bands took the major playing performances throughout the state. So in the early 20th century Utah, brass bands faced the same problems as American bands, an indicator that Utah was no longer a purely Mormon community, but a fully fledged part of the Union. And other forms of entertainment and standardized policies replaced them. The larger and more popular concert bands, the popularity of jazz, and technological revolutions, including audio recordings and personal transportation, played large roles in the evolving American cultural landscape. The country changed. The church changed. The state changed. The people changed. And in ensuing years, brass bands disappeared from both the Mormon and American consciousness. Yet to people who heard them, brass bands were an invaluable part of early Mormon life. Historian Kate B. Carter has said, "These early musicians set a standard and a tradition for excellence in their choice of music and its professional performance that greatly influenced its development in all outlying settlements, as well as in Salt Lake City." Horace G. Whitney, music editor of the Deseret News, made the following comment about the Nauvoo Brass Band and sums up the importance of brass bands in Mormon communities. "Perhaps someday in the future art of music among the saints, there will be, perhaps someday in the future the art of music among the saints will rise to such great importance that there will be a building in one of the educational centers of the church devoted exclusively to music culture. Should that time come, I would like to see in its halls a memorial tablet to the pioneer musicians of Utah, and especially in honor of the Nauvoo Brass Band, setting forth their organization by the prophet Joseph Smith, how they marched forth from Nauvoo together, how they preserved their organization across the plains, how together they, around many a campfire, cheered the hearts of the despairing, how they visited the towns en route and gave entertainments to help the poor of the pioneer train, how they reorganized in Great Salt Lake City, and not only enlivened the assemblages of people with their stirring strains, but implanted in the community that love and taste for music which spread throughout the state and gave Utah so much the musical reputation she enjoys today." Thank you.
Okay, we have some time for some questions. I'm sure you guys have questions. I would like to say you are an incredibly articulate speaker. That was fascinating. So if you have questions, please come up to the microphone, and that's what we'll do right now.
How well did these guys actually play? Pointing the mountain out there at Lake Town. What did they do for musical training, and where did they get their instruments? So after the railroad came, it's obvious. Did they use fives? Did they use big ones, for example? And what about bass instruments? I saw one guy with the honest goodness sousaphone in one of those pictures, but everybody else seemed to be playing either old mellophones or the euphoniums or something or other.
Yeah, the biggest ones that they would have had, the big bass horns, they would have had over-the-shoulder varieties that would have gone backwards. And there was a whole host of different brass instruments. You know, we think of brass instruments today as trumpets, French horns, trombones, tubas, and euphoniums. That's what we think of. Back then, there was much less standardization in instruments. Instruments covered the gamut from the sousaphone style stuff to the serpent style stuff, which looks like this, and you've got all sorts of sax horns, which were created by the same one who created the saxophone, Adolf Sax. But they were brass instruments, and they had large bells. Some of them went backwards, some of them you'd carry, and they'd go forwards. So there's no real standardization, but there are popular trends that kind of weave themselves through in both in American culture. They would get the instruments from various places. Some records that I've heard have them gone to Evanston, Wyoming, and they would travel there probably by horse or whatever, carriage, and bring them back. Fundraising for them was an interesting thing, too. Even back in Nauvoo days, the Prophet Joseph Smith was fundraising for band instruments. So if you think that those kids who are coming around and asking for candy bar money nowadays, you know, if you think they're new at it, this has been going on a long time. Joseph Smith held a performance on his steamer he made of Iowa where all proceeds went to the band in order to pay for instruments. Brigham Young did a similar thing. He held concerts that would raise money for bands. And as towns gradually gathered the money, they would create bands. Having someone who knew music was very important. We shouldn't be thinking that these are really super professional bands. You know, we're not hearing John Philip Sousa's band, which were the top of the line in bands at the time. These were community bands. They had some clunkers in there. They had some notes that you just kind of probably wanted to turn away from. But at the same time, this was an opportunity for people from the community, and not just in a town community, but probably from far away, farms well away, coming in and spending time visiting together. Band rehearsal was probably a pretty long thing because you'd go and you'd come together at the end of your workday, you'd play for several hours, you'd be taught how to read music and how to play music by perhaps a music master or a professor, as they would call them at that time. And then you might spend the rest of the evening socializing until midnight or so and then take your wagon back. So this was a big investment for these people. But it came with a certain amount of stature, too. If you were in a band, you were really looked up to. People really loved watching the band members, and they kind of idolized them. And if you were a teacher of bands, someone like William Pitt, who ran the Nauvoo Brass Band, or Domenico Ballo, I mean, these guys were idolized. They were huge in the town. Brigham Young had a whole concert hall built just for Domenico Ballo because he loved his band music so much. Although he didn't like his E-flat clarinet playing. He said it was too whiny. So he had opinions about
E-flat clarinet.
Well, yes, it's E-flat clarinet, so it makes a lot of sense. Yes, sir.
How were these brass bands used in church services? And you mentioned the temple as well. Mm-hmm. At what point did that go away? And how were they used within the service?
Sure. By services, I shouldn't be implying that, you know, this is the, normal temple. I guess we should look at today's first. If we look at today's general temple dedicatory services, you have the groundbreaking, choir, an organ usually, or choir, piano singing. And then you have the dedication, again, choir and organ, generally the thing for making music. We've relegated all of this brass band style enthusiasm, maybe, into the cultural events the night before, in many ways. At the time, Mormons used a very martial style, you know, a very military style for building their buildings. So when the cornerstones were laid, the brass band would start at the head of the procession and would play them to that first cornerstone. And that cornerstone would be dedicated, and a speech would be made. And then the band would play the whole procession to the next cornerstone, and so on and so forth. And they would play for each of those. Similarly, when they did capstone ceremonies, some of these were direct ceremonies, like the 1892 Salt Lake one, where there was obviously a big, big deal of electricity to lower, you know, the capstone in place. The brass band played there in a very formal setting. The brass band played in a comparative way in the St. George one, very informal. The last stone was laid on the St. George Temple. The brass band was there. And they paraded all of the workers back into town where, I can't remember, I want to say it was Erastus Snow, said a few words of celebration to them and then dismissed the band. And then they played again the next day for a bigger celebration that was more formal. So again, some of these were formal, some were informal. For the St. George one also, there were three brass bands located on top of the temple during the actual dedication service. So as people were coming into the service or leaving the service, there would be brass band music playing in any direction as they were leaving the building. And there's lots of other interesting stories, too. If you go back to Nauvoo times, the brass band played at the cornerstone for the, for the Nauvoo temple. They also played for the capstone for the Nauvoo temple, if I remember correctly. And they actually played inside the temple as well for an invitation by Brigham Young to go and play. He invited them in after a day's work of temple work, and they rolled back the carpets, and they had a dance, and they played, and the band played, and then they all went to sleep, so in separate rooms.
My great-grandfather was leader of the Lehigh Brass Band from 1870 to 1890, and I've done a lot of research on that, and I've written an article about it. But that band seemed to have a dual identity. When they needed instruments, the city bought the instruments, and they either bought them in American Fork or they ordered them from the East. But when there was problems among the band members, the bishop adjudicated. So it was kind of a civic thing and a church thing.
Yep. I think you're right. And not just in Lehigh, I think all around, you know, I mean, church and the separation of church and civic is pretty malleable during this time. You know, I mean, there's an awful lot of overlap. My ancestors lived in American Fork for some time. And certainly there, as well as other places, there are stories about the bishops getting involved in all sorts of things, you know, that we today probably would just go, let the police settle that. So, by the way, I think I've read your article.
And
I think I have it, and I think actually that picture of the Lehigh Brass Band and the bandwagon is from your article, so thank you, don't sue me. I'd love to talk to you more about it.
I've got several questions. First of all, sort of following up on what you were talking about, the brass band function in temple dedications and groundbreakings and whatnot, what about in ward meetings? Were they ever used in what we call sacrament meeting?
The answer is yes. And there's not a lot of evidence of what they played. They're just mentioned, to my knowledge. I've been trying to find sacrament meeting ones, but I haven't found a lot. And Michael Hicks, who's the other one who I did a little bit of research on some of that stuff he's found. I don't remember him saying that he found any either. So,
do you have any sense, were they accompanying or were they,
I think
were
that
they're performing?
I think that from what I get is, I think the best place to look is in conferences. There was one in Heber that was a really good one to reference here, where Joseph F. Smith came. The band played as they came in and then played during the meeting before he spoke, and then played at the end afterwards. I don't recall if they played another time during the meeting. So, but they definitely played inside these meetings to some extent. My guess is once the organ becomes accessible from the East, once the railroad comes in and we can bring an organ in, we don't need the brass band as much because we have an instrument that's functional, that's easy to get. And, you know, during the 1850s and 60s, that's a little bit harder to come by, which means that the instruments you have are what they play with.
Okay, so then my follow-up question to that would be, so is that, would that be something that would be atypical for other American communities, that the use of brass band in religious services?
Yeah, there's a great comment, and I wish I had the quote with me right now, and it was by Thomas Jefferson or someone near Thomas Jefferson at the time. The military band at the time, the Marine band, came and played at a church service, and the response was just, I believe the word that they used was ridiculous. They said it was just ridiculous for the to have this martial band trying to accompany the psalm singing. And again, think about some of the religions that are going on back there that aren't as progressive as the Mormon religion. Mormons are really a very progressive group. You know, they're more like, I guess you could say, more of the Baptist or Methodists, who are doing more revival stuff, who are a little bit more lively, more open to their popular music. Try taking someone who maybe has Church of England persuasion beforehand, or maybe something more along the Catholic Mass tradition. Brass bands are going to be hard to swallow. So they definitely didn't accompany that terribly well. But that is definitely a difference between American and Mormons, and where they definitely separated from it. There's another one too. I can't remember where it was from, but in New England, it said that they played at the services for a church dedication, and they said it was a desecration of the New England Sabbath. One of my favorite ones that he said they just couldn't stand it. No, we can't take this. So.
My final question is, where did these bands come from? I think you maybe mentioned one band sort of being formed on the request of Joseph Smith.
Mm-hmm.
But are they, I guess, who's instigating these bands? Are they garage bands? are they being is it church authorities that are having them formed? Is it civic authorities that are having them formed? Or are they just sort of naturally forming? You know?
I think it's a little bit of several different things. If you look back at Nauvoo times, yes, there is that Joseph Smith instigation for brass band. Here we go. After Joseph Smith, you look at Brigham Young, and yes, there were definitely band musicians who he sent out, and who he specifically, I mean, he issued musical callings. You know, he called the leader of the Nauvoo Legion musical ensemble, Edward Duzette was his name. He said that his call to be the music leader was a call from God. So, I mean, there were definitely times when it was very specific. But you also have to look at brass bands as an exceptionally popular thing in the East. By the end of the Civil War, and going up through the rest of the century, end of the Civil War, there's over 10,000 brass bands in America. They're everywhere. And this is what people want to listen to. This is what people really get into. And so I think as people, more and more people start coming west into Utah, that's when it starts becoming more of a popular, okay, let's get a brass band going. Community leaders saying, we need something for entertainment. Our people are out in the middle of nowhere trying to build a culture and a community. What can we do to help them? Let's give them some entertainment. And so let's raise money, and let's order instruments, and let's teach them. And it evolves. It starts with the church and then moves into that malleable church, you know, church community culture that exists for several decades in Utah, and then relegates itself to the community side as we get closer and closer to statehood and beyond.
I'll be sure. This is fascinating. So when a brass band's playing a dance, they can play for half an hour. For, you know, 40 minutes before the trumpet players get really tired.
Right.
So you have to have two bands playing. I mean, in big bands, for instance, in the 40s and 50s, you'd have two bands at each side.
Yeah.
What were the mechanics of having a brass band or two or three at a dance or at a big social function?
That's a really good question, and one that I'm not sure that I know a complete answer to. The picture that I have, let me see if I can get this for you here. It was this one. Let's see if I can get this so that you can see. If you look at this picture specifically, there's actually two. Where is it? There's one down here at the bottom, and there's one up here at the top for the dance. And so definitely, I mean, this is like Battle of the Bands at its max, you know. Okay, once somebody is done playing, they give each other a spell and off they go. In Utah, again, this is the New York version here. In Utah, there is definitely a little bit of that going on. And there's some competition in some ways. William Pitt, who was the leader of the Nauvoo Brass Band, and Domenico Ballo, who was leader of the Ballo Band, were the two big popular leaders. And their bands were the popular bands. And there was some rumored contention at times, not so much between the two band leaders, but just of who's most popular. And sometimes they would come together, and they had parties with three bands together, and a band would play, and everyone would socialize, and another band would play, and they'd all socialize. There is that on record. Whether or not they were always, you know, planned, per se, you know, and saying, okay, now you're going to play, now you're going to play, or this is our set, we're going to play these five tunes, are you playing the same two? Are you going to play Yankee Doodle like we are? I'm not sure. I don't know. But they definitely were there, and they definitely played together. And from what I gather, most of the time the musicians were on really good terms and just shared the stage in a lot of places. Most of the time. It is interesting that William Pitt went on a mission not long after he came here to England. So, Domenico Ballo became exceptionally popular after that. So I'm not implying anything.
Which I suppose brings up the next question.
Yes.
Where did they get the music? I mean, that one you had on the on there looked like it was written for three people who could really play and a bunch of other people. I noticed when you were playing it, it was a very simple AABA form. Is that pretty typical?
It's very difficult.
A couple skilled players and everybody else fills in.
That's exactly right. I mean, you're looking at a very typical, what do we know? What do we have to work with? Some musicians, some leaders brought music with them. William Pitt brought a trunk full of brass band music from England, and that's what they used. I wish we still had that trunk. Family tradition holds that a son or someone got angry and burned the box, which is heart-wrenching to me. But yeah, I mean, this is very typical stuff, and typical for what you'd hear in the East as well. You know, you look at polkas or quadrilles, those are forms that were very comfortable in the East and were played in the West. Very similar stuff. This particular piece here, this is the Capstone March that we were listening to earlier. I like this one because it's partially because I found it again, but partially because it's dedicated to the First Presidency right there. But it is, it's very typical AABA form, march form for the time.
I noticed that it isn't even transposing.
No.
Oh, it's not. Wow.
No. It's very, very straightforward.
No, all the cornet parts are written in C just like the flute.
Yep. And a lot of instruments then would have been. Brass band instruments during the 19th century were C instruments in a lot of cases, so that anyone could play any instrument. Your bugle player starts getting tired of playing the high notes. Okay, well, let's switch and let's put him on the bass for a minute and let him let his lips relax a little bit. Why not? Extends the performance time and gives him a chance to play a bunch of different things.
How much of this, like, of course, like you said, there are some people who brought music with them from the East.
This is
going to
be podcasted.
there's a lot of music being brought from the East, so they're playing music that's the same as the rest of the music being played across America. But then eventually there's some music that's being written locally. Mm-hmm. How much of that was being done? Who was doing it? And how much of it survives?
Not very much survives, to my knowledge. If any of you know where any original brass band music is, please let me know. I would love to see it. That's part of my hunt, is to go and find original brass band pieces and bring them to light. There are a couple down from the Mount Pleasant area that I have. There's certainly a few in libraries. Utah State has a couple. University of Utah has a couple. Brigham Young University has a couple. They have an original brass band booklet as well. But not very much survives. And who's writing it? This is an interesting question, because certainly those who are trained in music, the ones that Brigham Young is sending out, the Staleys who go down to Santa Clara and he starts a brass band down there, certainly was writing it. William Pitt was certainly writing it. Some of the other band leaders going up north into Farmington and Ogden are certainly writing it. But a lot of it I'm sensing is not just written, but taught by rote. Okay, ready, trumpet players? Here's your line. Okay, here we go. Ready? Now you do it. Okay, there we go. And they learn their brass part that way. So, how much is there? Not much. How much was written? Probably a bit. How much is by rote? Probably a bit, too. So, it's a great question. Again, if you know of where any is, please let me know. I'd love to find out more.
Okay, let's thank Brian. This was just fascinating. I could listen for another hour and a half. Thank you so much,
thank
all
you.
Of you.
Thank you.